The Leah Harapan Show. BitMEX, the OG crypto derivatives platform and the best place to buy your Bitcoin.
Things really are just starting to heat up.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the Leah Harapan Show, where we have some of the hottest, most taboo conversations that you're sort of not allowed to have anywhere else. So I'm very excited for today's guest. But before I bring on my guest, please don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe so you support the channel and so you never miss a video. Okay, so let's do this. Let's kick things off because there's been a lot of stuff in the news that I want to unpack today. So my guest today, he is a professor, evolutionary behavioral scientist, the author of multiple books, including The Parasitic Mind, and the host of the YouTube channel, The Sad Truth. If you haven't guessed it, it is Gad Sad. Gad, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Like I said before we went live, I've been following a lot of your work, your books, seen your many different podcasts, obviously the Joe Rogan one in particular. And I think you have a lot of really interesting things to say about the crazy world that we're living in right now. So I'm very excited to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to our conversation.
All right, let's kick this off because I've seen a lot of weird things happening in the media this week. And in particular was the campaign that came out from Balenciaga. So for those that don't know, Balenciaga put out this weird kind of child pornography, child bondage, BDSM campaign. And it's very strange. And the whole world is quite caught off guard from this. So firstly, have you seen the campaign?
I've only seen exactly what you said, which is there was some kind of BDSM ad with clearly a motif of a child. But that's about all I know about it.
Okay, so I think what shocked me was that this isn't the first time we're seeing children sexualized. We see this a lot with the whole trans and drag queen community. I've seen, you know, drag queen story hour. And the funny thing is that there's just not much outrage about this from, you know, celebrities, mainstream media. So I want to get your take on, you know, why are we seeing such silence when it comes to children, but we see outrage, you know, when it comes to saying that men, you know, men can't get pregnant or only women have periods. Like, it's very simple scientific things like this, but when it comes to the sexualization of children, it's silent. What's your take on this? Why is this happening?
I mean, there are several ways by which one can speculate why it's happening. So I'll use the following line. So when I'm talking to my students about advertising to children, I will often tell them that, you know, there's a contradiction in the following sense. You're not allowed to target directly a child to sell them some product because their brains are not sufficiently formed, but you're able to target them straight out of the womb about your favorite religion. So there is kind of a contradiction here. I can't sell you chewing gum until you're 12, but I can sell you my favorite religious narrative when you are one day old. And the reason I think for that is because when I'm trying to sell you my favorite religious narrative, it is best for me to access you when you are most malleable, when it is easiest for me to be able to sell you this stuff so that hopefully you become part of my religion forevermore. You don't have the cognitive defenses that will allow you to counter argue against my message. So if you were born in Mecca, you become Muslim. If you were born in Italy, you're likely to be Christian. If you're born in Israel, you're likely to be Jewish, and so on. And so I think that when it comes to trans activism, the idea is that we need to normalize children seeing men dressed as women who somehow become women, because then we are getting rid of bigotry, right? So I think it starts off with a noble cause, right? And that's why you have things like twerking drag queens. Well, what's wrong with teaching children how to read in a library while a drag queen is twerking? I don't necessarily think that it's coming from a diabolical place, at least in that example, to try to sexualize or groom the children. But I think that it's part of the, you know, grand effort to normalize these things. If I can convince a three-year-old that it is perfectly okay for some women to have 9-inch penises, well, then when they will eventually go to some baloney liberal arts college when they are 21 years old, they won't contest the idea that sometimes men can menstruate as well. So I think that's the reflex where that comes from.
Yeah, I understand that. speaking to children about certain ideas when they're young definitely instills a certain level of indoctrination, which you can't get rid of. Just for context, I'm Jewish and I went to a Jewish school my life. So the indoctrination for the love of Israel is powerful, is very powerful. Only something that I realize now I'm a bit older, actually. You know, now I have the ability to think for myself. It's really, really interesting. But why are we at a point where we can't say that's not okay though? Like, I understand about, you know, pushing a level of equality, trying to normalize certain things, but isn't it just inappropriate? Like, why can't we have that kind of conversation?
I mean, certainly when it comes to children, I would say, yes, of course, it's inappropriate. But again, the more general reflex, I think, it's that they are trying to normalize certain things as part of the, you know, it's my truth, right? So who are you to say that genitalia determines your biological sex? And I know that later we will get into to my last book, but it really is part of all these idea pathogens, all of which start off with a noble goal, right? So I don't think they originally start off trying to be diabolical. So for example, when it comes to militant feminism, it started originally as a good idea. Equity mm-hmm. feminism was the notion that, hey, men and women should be treated equally under the law. And I think most of us and all your viewers would probably agree. Yeah, that makes sense. The problem then comes when you metamorphize that idea into, in the pursuit of seeking, equality between the sexes, we have to argue that the sexes are indistinguishable from each other. We have to argue that all sex differences could not be due to biological reasons. They must be part of social construction. So it starts off as a noble cause, but then it veers into lunacy because of this original overriding noble goal. And I always argue that I can chew gum and walk at the same time. I could be fully in support of trans people not being discriminated against, whilst also not agreeing with the idea that boys too can menstruate. So I don't need to cede a millimeter of truth in the pursuit of a noble goal.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It just blows my mind that we can't have these open conversations. And I want to get your take. Would you say this would have happened, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago? And how has society changed in that sense? And do you think it's changed for the better or for the worse?
Well, certainly from the perspective of these parasitic ideas, you needed to have the slow erosion of our edifices of reason in order to be able to be sitting in the 21st century talking about whether men too can menstruate and bear children. It is so outlandish that, to your point, to your question, you had to kind of soften the defenses, the reason defenses, in order for these ideas to be palatable to most people, right? I mean, look, Leia, I gave a testimony in front of the Canadian Senate in 2017. At the time, it was regarding Bill C-16, which in Canada was the bill that was trying to incorporate gender expression and gender identity under the rubric of hate crimes. And of course, I was perfectly in support of the idea that nobody should be discriminated against. But again, to my earlier point, that doesn't mean that we should be arguing that men too can menstruate and that men can have children and so on. But it is so important for people to defend those rights that they have to slowly eradicate our natural defenses against such stupidity, right? And so I don't think it would have probably phoned 40, 50 years ago, these specific idea pathogens, but this doesn't mean that in the past we haven't succumbed to other lunatic ideas. In other words, the capacity for the human mind to be parasitized has always existed, except that now we are falling prey to a new set of parasitic ideas. That's the difference.
And so what you're saying is that in order to get to where we are today, it's been a slow, gradual erosion of reality. So where do you think it first started?
Well, I hate to say it because I am a professor, but it's the culprits are the professors who spread these nonsensical ideas originally within the university ecosystem. So all of the idea pathogens that I talk about, postmodernism, cultural relativism, social constructivism, militant feminism, each of these ideas were originally spawned in some highfalutin ivory tower. And when I was warning people about these idea parasites, these ideological parasites, the typical response I would get, yeah, sure, that sounds as a form of lunacy, but isn't it in just some esoteric department in the humanities or in the social sciences? And then I would always tell them, perhaps in a prophetic way, but these bad ideas will eventually break out of the lab, right? Just like the COVID, at least to the best of our knowledge, is a virus that eventually, you know, broke out of the lab. These idea pathogens might start off in a very constrained environment, but eventually they enter journalism and human resources department, and they even become the Prime Minister of Canada. And so this kind of dismissive idea that I have often faced, which is, come on, stop screaming from the top of the mountain about these idea pathogens. It's just some BS that's taking place in university campuses. Well, now we see that, you know, bad ideas have downstream negative consequences.
What confuses me is I understand that it starts off as a noble cause. Like I don't regard myself as a feminist, for example, but I understand where it came from and I respect that and everything. But what I don't understand is why we're at a point whereby people can't just look at facts in reality. Like when did that break down? You know, like you have the Prime Minister of Canada. How is a Prime Minister endorsing nonsense?
So to answer your question, I have to identify what I call the granddaddy of all parasitic ideas, and that's postmodernism. Because postmodernism is the epistemological tool that allows me to argue that there are no objective truths, not one, nothing. Everything is shackled by subjectivity. Everything is shackled by my idiosyncratic reality. Everything is shackled by relativity. And therefore, it's precisely that, quote, philosophical framework that allows me to then say, well, of course, some women do have 9-inch penises. What's wrong with that? That's totally feasible. And here, I'd like to maybe repeat a story that I hope not too many of you viewers have heard me mention elsewhere, but it's even worth hearing again because it speaks exactly to your question of how can we believe such nonsense. So in 2002, so this is 20 years ago, one of my doctoral students had just defended his PhD dissertation. And so we were going out for a celebratory dinner. And it was myself, my wife, him, and he was bringing along a date. Do you know the story, by the way?
No, I'm
okay. Curious. Okay. Well, good. Then it's even more exciting to share it with you because you haven't heard it before. So he calls me up before that dinner on that day to mm-hmm. kind of give me a heads up to say that the lady that he's bringing along for that dinner is a graduate student in postmodernism, women's studies, and cultural anthropology, to which I said, so the Holy Trinity of bullshit. Now, of course, he was telling me all this because, you know, his point was, you know, let's have a fun time. Let's not get into all of these rabbit holes. I said, oh, yeah, no problem. I understand. I'll be on my best behavior, which, of course, was a complete lie because I wasn't going to be on my best behavior. And so about halfway through the evening, I turned to the lady in question and I said, so you're a you study postmodernism, correct? Yes. So there are no universal truths? No. Okay, well, I'm an evolutionary psychologist, so I do think that there are universal truths, certainly when it comes to human nature and so on. So do you mind if I posit what I consider to be a universal and then you could tell me how I'm wrong? She goes, yeah, sure, go for it. I said, okay, is it not true that within Homo sapiens, humans, only women bear children? Now, this is 20 years ago, so it's way before the transgender craze. Is it not true that only women bear children? So she looks at me with complete derision. She can't believe that someone could be such a simpleton. She says, no, it's not true. I said, it's not true that only women bear children. I said, how is that? She said, well, because there is some Japanese tribe off some Japanese island whereby within their mythological folkloric realm, it is the men who bear children. So by you restricting the conversation to the biological realm, you know, that's how you keep us barefoot and pregnant. So once I recovered from the mini stroke that I had at being exposed to such stupidity, yes, I said, okay, well, let me perhaps then, maybe it was too corrosive, it was too dangerous, it was too controversial to posit something as difficult to hear as only women bear children. Let me give you another example. Is it not true since time immemorial that sailors have relied on the following cosmological reality, that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west? Is that not true? Is that not universally true? So here she used a variant of postmodernism called deconstructionism, and its founder is Jacques Derrida. the French postmodernist philosopher, whereby there is no reality other than that that is defined by language. So there is no reality outside of language. So there she says, well, what do you mean by East and West? Those are just arbitrary labels. And what do you mean by the sun? That which you call the sun, I might call dancing hyena. I mean, literally her words, verbatim.
Okay.
So I said, okay, well, fine. Then the dancing hyena rises in the East and in the West. And then she answered, I don't play those label games. So why do I always repeat that story? Because it perfectly captures the intellectual terrorism of postmodernism. Because if I can't agree with a graduate student that only women bear children, and if I can't agree with the graduate student that there is such a thing as East and West and the sun, then what can we agree on, right? So mm-hmm. And this is why in the book I talk about it being literally a form of intellectual terrorism. So to answer your question in a long-winded way, it's postmodernism is the bomb that brings down the edifices of reason that then allows me to believe anything because it's my truth that matters. There is no truth with a capital T.
Let's get into why this is dangerous, because I talk a lot about this and people often say to me, just let people be, you know, if they want to identify how they want to identify, let them be. Why do you have to be so nasty, Leia? Why do you have to, you know, call people out? Why can't you let them be? And I think it's because it's dangerous. But can you elaborate on why this idea is dangerous?
Well, look, if you wish to, let's say, for example, transgender issues, if you wish to self-identify as anything you want, that's great. If you ask me to go on the journey with you and uniquely celebrate your personhood, I don't need to play along, right? So for example, I don't need to be called a cisgender male. No, I'm just male. My wife is not cisgendered. She's a woman, and I have a son and I have a daughter. So in the pursuit, this is what I call the tyranny of the minority in my address to the Canadian Senate, right? 0.01% of folks are either transgender or non-binary or whatever the different appellations. That's great. And they should be treated with all the due respect, and they should not be discriminated against. I'm all for that. But in the pursuit of celebrating your personhood, I don't eradicate mine. So for example, the idea that we should no longer have on passports our biological sex, because what if I'm non-binary and then you're offending me? So 99.9% of humanity has to acquiesce to the 0.01. So that would be one example of how it's dangerous. It's dangerous to my fundamental dignity, right? I don't want any harm to befall you, and I want you to be treated with all dignity, but you don't get to then force me to put pronouns in my signature in my emails, right? I don't have to play along. So now there's a term, of course, that's called gaslighting, right? So gaslighting is truly dangerous because it attacks the most fundamental nature of what it is to be human, which is we've got this prefrontal cortex that allows us to reason. And when I am told with a metaphorical gun that you have to agree that some women have 9-inch penises, well, that is attacking what it is for me to be a human being that has the capacity to reason. So if for no other reason, that's why it's dangerous.
Yeah, I also think that it's where do we draw the line? Like if there's no fundamental truth anymore, then where do we draw the line? I'm often hearing, you know, I'm very pro female only safe spaces, despite the term safe spaces being ridiculous. I don't want men in my changing rooms. I don't want men in my toilets. I think that's dangerous for when I have children one day. And so for me, I'm not sure why it's, and we see this all the time, the majority have to accommodate for the minority.
And I think it's also because, you know, you've probably heard things like the progressive stack, or, I call it victimology poker, or you've heard oppression Olympics. This the argument there is that there is a hierarchy of victimology. So for example, yes, women who are in a rape shelter are victims, but their victimology score is not as great as the transgender person who wants to be in their space. Therefore, when these two victimology narratives are pitted against each other, sorry, raped women, transgender woman carries greater weight. One of the reasons why it's very difficult to come after me is because using that victimology poker calculus, I end up winning always because I'm the childhood war refugee, right, who escaped execution. So there is almost never, by definition, a victimology story that you're going to come up with, whether it's a real story or a manufactured one, a la Justice Smollett, that's going to outrank me. So if all else fails and you're whining about your victimology, well, I pull out my cards from my pocket and then you run away like a little girl.
I see. I don't think you're at the top of the victim hierarchy, Gavin.
Because I'm not gay. Because I'm not gay.
Because you're not like dark enough. You're not gay.
The dark.
You're not a woman.
Dark enough. Let me just say this. I mentioned this offline before we started. I'm looking ridiculously pale, especially compared to you. You don't want to see me when I have about 1% of the amount of sun that you currently have in Florida. That's true. Might revisit those words.
Okay. Well, right now, you know,
I'm a white supremacist. I agree.
Oh yeah. You're too much of a straight white man right now. Absolutely not. I want to talk about your book, Parasitic Mind, How Infectious Ideas Are Killing Common Sense. I love that title. It just sums everything up. So can you tell me about some of these infectious ideas that are killing everyday common sense?
Right. So I mentioned already one, postmodernism, that being the granddaddy of them all. Social constructivism would be another nefarious one. So social constructivism basically says that we are all born tabula rasa, empty slates, with no biological imperatives that are built into our psyche, with no differences in our biological potential. And it is only social construction that then makes us who we are. So why do women prefer certain types of men more than others? Well, it's because they saw it in Hollywood images. Why do men prefer certain types of women? It's because they learned what type of women to be attracted to through Beyonce videos, right? So we're tabula rasa, right? Now, again, going back to my earlier point about sort of how these idea pathogens start off as noble goals. So what is the noble goal with such nonsense? It is quite soothing, Leia, for me, if I'm a parent, to know that my child could be the next Lionel Messi. My child could be the next Albert Einstein, that there is absolutely nothing innately lesser about my child. Any child could be anything. That's a very hopeful message. It's a wonderful message, but it's also, if you don't mind me saying, perfectly bullshit, because I never had the same chance of being an NBA star as Michael Jordan did. He's taller than me. He jumps higher than me. Maybe he couldn't have been as good a soccer player as I was, but the idea that we are all born with equal potentiality and that it's only social construction that makes us who we are is simply nonsensical. So that would be another idea pathogen. Cultural relativism is another idea pathogen. Basically, it says that who are you to judge the cultural belief system, the cultural values, the patterns of behaviors of another culture. You have to judge each culture within its own idiosyncratic ecosystem. Of course, that can't be true. So for example, to your earlier question, when we first started our conversation, there should be some absolute moral standards about how we treat children. Mm-hmm. Everything is not relative. And it's precisely because cultural relativism has seeped its way into the psyche of many academics that then we say, but who are we to talk about pedophiles being bad people? Aren't they just minor attracted people? I don't know if you've seen that.
I've seen it.
So that new label, is trying to normalize. You know, there are different types of sexual attraction. Some of us prefer fat people, thin people. Some of us prefer same sex. Some of us prefer 5-year-olds, right? So again, it's that cocktail of idea pathogens. Throw in a bit of postmodernism, throw in a bit of social constructionism, throw a bit of cultural relativism, and then you get this departure from reason that we see. So what I do in the book is I first trace where these idea pathogens come from, the university ecosystem, and then I offer toward the end of the book a mental vaccine against these dreadful mind parasites.
Can we talk about the mental vaccine?
Of course we can. So there is a long-winded answer and a shorter one. Some of the shorter ones, so for example, the idea that most people diffuse the responsibility of fighting back against these ideas to others. You know, Gad Saad is strong enough. He's got broad shoulders. He'll speak for me, right? And therefore, I walk away from an opportunity to engage in debate. I'm not talking about being nasty or mean or impolite, right? But even if you're having a conversation on Facebook or your professor says something that's insane, challenge them politely at the pub, on Facebook, on Twitter, in your classroom. In other words, don't diffuse the responsibility on a few others, you know, who have it on your behalf. The other thing that I will tell people, and then I'll come to the more long-winded answer, I always tell people as a call to arms is to activate your inner honey badger. The reason why I use that imagery is because the honey badger is arguably the most fierce and ferocious animal in the animal kingdom. It's the size of a small dog, and yet it can intimidate 4, 5, 6 adult lions. How does it do that? It does it because it is extraordinarily ferocious. I mean, really, just go and check it on YouTube. Now, I ask people to be ideologically fierce. That doesn't mean impolite. It doesn't mean threatened with violence, but it means that when I know how to articulate a position, good luck to you trying to debate me. That's why I say all the things that I say, completely unencumbered by political correctness, by careerist concerns, because I walk like a 70-foot-tall honey badger. Not because I'm arrogant, not because I'm conceited, because when I know, I know. And when I don't know, I don't know, right? So I know I have epistemic humility. If you ask me, you know, what are the downstream effects of legalizing marijuana, I would say, you know, Leah, I don't know enough about this topic to offer you an answer. But when I know, then good luck to you if you wish to debate me, which now brings me to the long-winded answer of how do you develop a mind vaccine for truth? So here, please bear with me as I set up the ground. So in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, I have the chapter is titled How to Seek Truth. And I argue that you seek truth by building nomological networks of cumulative evidence. Now that's a mouthful. So let me explain what it is. So let's suppose you were to ask me, Leah, all right, are toy preferences innate or are they a social construction? Meaning that your parents teach little Johnny to play with the truck and little Linda to play with the doll. And I would say to you, no, they are universal instantiation of sex-specific toy preferences. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to build you that nomological network of cumulative evidence to demonstrate the veracity of my position. How do I do that? I will do that by getting you data from across cultures that demonstrate that sex specificity happens in exactly the same way. So that's one. So in the box of all the network, that's one data set, cross-cultural universality. That should be enough to convince you, but I'm not going to stop there because I'm going to build that nomological network that's going to drown you in a tsunami of evidence. So number two, I'm going to get you data from developmental psychology showing you that children who are too young to have been socialized, in other words, by definition, they could not have been socialized to hold those toy preferences, they already exhibit those preferences. So that gets rid of the possibility that those toy preferences were learned. Okay, so that's number two. I can get you data from other animals. I can get you data from vervet monkeys, from rhesus monkeys, from chimpanzees, showing you that they exhibit the same sex-specific toy preferences as human infants. I can get you data from across time periods. I can get you data from funerary monuments from 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, whereby children are depicted playing with the toys exactly as we would expect them today. So what am I basically doing? Metaphorically, I'm putting the epistemological noose around your neck by providing you data from across cultures, across time periods, across species, across disciplines, all of which triangulate into demonstrating that my position is the correct one. So the way that you adjudicate between different positions when you're debating someone is that you hopefully have the cognitive stamina to build that nomological network. Now, that vaccine that I just offered hinges on one issue. Well, two issues. Number one, my interlocutor to whom I'm trying to make that point can't be going, la, 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 I don't want to hear it. Because if they do that, then all of the nomological network in the world is not going to convince you. Number two, it hinges on the fact that I need to be sufficiently motivated to spend the necessary effort to build that nomological network. The problem is that most individuals are cognitive misers. They're lazy. Therefore, if Barack Obama, peace be upon him, tells me that Islam is peace, then it's peace. I don't bother to actually conduct the nomological network that would allow me to adjudicate the position of whether Islam is peaceful or not. But that notwithstanding, if the person with whom I'm debating is intellectually honest enough to grant me the courtesy to show him my nomological network, and if I am sufficiently motivated to build that nomological network, that's how you vaccinate yourself against bullshit.
I think that having that network of evidence and facts is key. It takes a lot of cognitive effort and capacity in order to do that and provide that. But you know, I think even there is a lot of information out there, and I think people still, you know, like you said, refuse to consider reality. So I want to understand, why do you think that this mentality has such a grip on people? Why are they easily adopting these ideas and refuse to adopt better, healthier ideas? Like, you know, Jordan Peterson says, get your house in order, make your bed, take personal responsibility. You know, there's some really amazing speakers that promote such incredibly useful ideas and beneficial ideas for humanity. And yet that can't get a grip on people yet. You know, this victim mentality, this refusing to see the world, refusing to acknowledge reality, has got a grip on people. And just as a side point as well, and the whole thing about obesity falls into that. You know, the way they're promoting obesity, and you know, why are they doing this?
So depending on which idea pathogen we're talking about, the answer to the why might be different. Let's take, okay, for example, obesity. Okay,
right.
To focus on a particular idiotic idea. Look, I growing up, I was always incredibly thin. I was a very competitive soccer player. And then over the next 20, 25 years, I put on tons of weight. So much so that 2.5, 3 years ago, I weighed in at well over 200 pounds. And then I decided that I wanted to do something about it. And I lost tons of weight. And this is why I've now returned to the status of Adonis. which, of course, you're going to agree with.
I agree. Absolute Adonis.
Now, I could have easily done the following thing. I could have followed the Lizzo model, right? Which is, I'm grossly overweight. I can do one of two things. I can do all of the hard work, which is to assume personal agency and personal responsibility and, you know, starve myself for a year so that I can lose all this weight, exercise. Or I can argue that it's a complete medical conspiracy that obesity results in downstream negative effects on my health. And it's a complete social construction that men don't like 800-pound women. If only we can convince men through better media images that, their fantasies lie in you know, having sex with 800-pound women, then I would be loved, right? Well, it's a lot easier for me, again, to go back to the earlier point when I said that people are cognitive misers. People are, never mind that they're intellectually lazy. Most people are just inherently lazy about anything, right? So I've got two choices. Either I assume a victimology mindset, which is not very difficult to do, or I starve myself for the next year and a half. I lost, by the way, Leia, 86 pounds, okay?
Wow.
Now, you would think, and certainly someone at my age, right? It's not, I'm 20, my metabolism is slower. You would think it's pretty difficult to lose that weight. But, well, it is very difficult. But if you're sufficiently committed and you do so on every single day, eventually one day you get on the scale and you're the perfect weight that you're supposed to be at. So now, incidentally, to continue with the obesity example, I have a chapter a section in the book called All Roads Lead to Bigotry. Mm-hmm. And let me explain what I mean by that. So if I am grossly overweight as a woman, I can argue that any state of the world demonstrates that people are fattest, okay? They're bigoted against overweight mm-hmm. people. If a guy says, I'm uniquely attracted to overweight women, then the answer will be, well, you are fetishizing my fat folds. And I hate the fact that you only find me sexually attractive because I'm 800 pounds. So that's one. So if I'm attracted to you because you're fat, it's bad and you're a victim. If I'm not attracted to you because you're fat, if I say I specifically am not sexually attracted to 800-pound women and would rather, you know, have sex with women that have the hourglass figure, well, then you are a fattest because it is society that taught you to not be attracted. So if I'm attracted to fat women, I'm a Nazi. And if I'm not attracted to fat women, I'm a Nazi.
You're still a Nazi.
Exactly. And so to answer your question, I mean, to kind of summarize what I said, it's a lot easier for people to be victims, right? It's a lot easier. Now, let's take the general victimology thing of, you know, we were slaves 300 years ago, or indigenous people were mistreated 200 years ago. I'm not minimizing those historical grievances, but I don't need to go 300 years ago to talk about grievances. I put on running shoes and ran really quickly as an 11-year-old so that my head was not detached from the rest of my body. I don't need to reference even my Holocaust, tribe members. That's only 75 years ago. I experienced it. My parents were kidnapped by Fatah and tortured, right? My wife's family escaped Lebanon also. Before that, they escaped Turkey in the Armenian genocide. And yet we don't wallow in victimology because we recognize that this is an inherent part of our history. We recognize it. It's part of who we are. But then we say, you know what's going to make us successful is if we overcome that tragic start to life that we had. And here I stand with the lovely Leia, having a conversation. I could have been wallowing in a corner crying, boo-hoo-hoo, they did this to me when I was 11. And again, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't own and accept the victimology that you've had, but move past it. But regrettably, it has become orgiastic to wallow in victimology. And I have a section in The Parasitic Mind where I talk about Munchausen syndrome, which might be able to answer your original question of what's the deal with all this victimology. The idea to offer that theory came to me from a 2010 paper that I had written in a scientific journal. It was in a medical journal where I was talking about an evolutionary explanation for Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Let me explain two things. Munchausen syndrome is basically, it's a psychiatric disorder whereby someone feigns a medical illness in order to garner empathy and sympathy, right? There's an orgiastic need for people to be coming to me and say, oh, poor you. So even if I'm not sick, I will fake being sick so that I can get that from you. That's called Munchausen syndrome. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is even more diabolical in that I take someone who's under my care, my pet, my elderly parent, but most commonly my biological child, and I harm them so that I can get the empathy and sympathy by proxy. And so I had written this paper in 2010 and it stayed there. And then as I was writing The Parasitic Mind and I was trying to explain what is it that makes it at the collective level so alluring for everybody to be competing in victimology scores, I said, aha, it's collective Munchausen and collective Munchausen by proxy. So the original genesis of that idea came to me in that 2010 paper, which I then extended now to the current zeitgeist. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, you haven't. It makes a lot of sense. The thing which still confuses me, because I understand, you know, people don't want to take personal responsibility. I understand, you know, people, the attention that comes when you're a victim and when you need someone to care for you and all these sorts of things. I get that. But, you know, what kind of makes me uncomfortable is when these ideas are pushed by politicians. So AOC, for example, I saw her once tweet and she called the Republican Party the personal responsibility party, like as if it's bad to take personal responsibility. So that's a question that I have. Why would they pretend that it's bad to take personal responsibility? And do you think at any point there are actually politicians and people at the top who understand what is happening and yet still push this agenda despite knowing that it's actually bad?
Yeah, so I'll take your last point first. That's a great question because I often ask myself that, so I'll just rephrase what you said. Do you truly believe in your bullshit in the deep recesses of your mind, or is just this performative? Yeah. And, you know, I kind of oscillate. At times I say to myself that they have to ultimately believe it in some form or another. Otherwise, they wouldn't be as good charlatans as they truly are. Because, so there's, let me do a little parenthesis, a tangential thing. There's a theory in evolutionary psychology that speaks to the idea of why is it that humans have evolved the capacity for self-deception? Why are we so good at lying to ourselves? And the gentleman, the evolutionary biologist who offered an explanation, his name is Robert Trivers. It's a brilliant, brilliant explanation. And the argument goes like this, Leia. So if I am trying, you and I are involved in an evolutionary arms race. I'm trying to dupe you into going into the back of the cabin with me. And you're trying to gauge whether I'm an honest suitor, right? And so as I evolve better strategies at, you know, manipulating you, you evolve counter strategies, hence the evolutionary arms race. So what's a counter strategy that you're evolving? Well, you want to read cues of duplicity in me. You want to read my face or tonality or the subtle things that I'm saying to gauge whether I am truthful or not. Now, one of the ways that I can shut off those cues that otherwise would be showing that I am lying to you is if I first believe it myself. So the first act of being able to manipulate you better, Leia, is if I can convince myself of the lie. Because now when you're looking at my eyes to pick up on those cues of duplicity, you won't find them because I've actually lied to myself first. So it's a brilliant theory. And so to your question, I think that occasional cortex, AOC. Now, there's a debate going on.
Occasional cortex.
You like that, huh?
It's funny.
There is a debate as to who came up with that term. Apparently, there's a radio host called Michael Savage, unbeknownst to me, has been using that term. I'm here to repeat again. It is the independent humor of Gadsad that came up with occasional. I've written papers in neuroscience, so I understand the cortex. So no, not steal it from my
copywriter. You need to copyright it after the show.
Exactly. So whether it be occasional cortex or whether it be the cackler in chief, Kamala Harris or whomever, I think that they find a way to believe those things so that they could be better purveyors of bullshit to the morons, you know, that they're speaking to.
So that would imply that they are actively trying to deceive, though.
I think so, right? Because ultimately, politicians are in the game of power. And the more people that I can control and have under my dominion, the more orgiastically pleasurable it is. And therefore, I don't like the idea of you assuming personal responsibility and personal agency, because the more freedom and personal agency you have, the less I have dominion over your life. So I think in this very grotesque manner, yes, it is duplicitous and it is willful and so on.
Yeah, that's also what I agree. I have a very cynical outlook, unfortunately, and I definitely do think it's done to keep people under the thumb and keep them down. I think control is always the ultimate goal. Something which I think is really interesting is the cognitive dissonance that took over the last 2.5, nearly 3 years. I don't want to say the words in case YouTube takes it down or thinks we're, you know, spreading ill misinformation or anything like that, you know. But what really fascinates me is the way people have adopted these ideas like it's a religion. So do you think, to some extent, I know obviously society's become far more secular than it ever was. Do you think that to some extent people are replacing these, replacing God, replacing religion with these weird ideologies in order to, you know, give their life some form of meaning, direction, and purpose?
I do. And there are several ways that we can draw an analogy between a, you know, standard religion and the woke religion. So, for example, the idea of revealed truths that are sacred, that are sacrosanct, that you're not allowed to challenge. Well, of course, that's central in religion, right? I mean, in religious dogma, you know, why is the truth in my book the truth? Because it's written in my book, and therefore it's a tautology circle, right? Don't question it, right? And so by a similar type of parasitic dogma, you're not allowed to question certain realities. So if you had said, is it Ellen Page that's become Elliot Page? Did I get those two names right? Okay. Yeah. So remember when, I can't remember who it was that was canceled because they dead named? Is that what it is?
Misgendered.
Misgendered.
Oh, they used the dead name. Oh, that's a weird thing that I've recently just come across. Yeah.
Exactly.
I can't remember who. Yeah.
So how could it be that in the 21st century, the species that can land people on the moon and that can solve Fermat's last theorem in pure mathematics and that can map the human genome can get someone canceled because of what we just talked about. That's absolutely insane. But that's what's happening. It's that's speaking of purpose and meaning, that's one of the things when I wake up in the day. I mean, there are many things that give me purpose and meaning, but one of which is that as a professor, I view it as my innate responsibility to fight back against untruths. And so when I wake up in the morning, I literally kind of rub my hands together. Who am I going to godsmack into oblivion today? I do it not because, you know, I'm this, irreverent contrarian who just wants to cause trouble. It's because I'm genuinely offended by bullshit. It really bothers me when I see these half-truths, these falsehoods. It's an attack on human reason, on human dignity. And so oftentimes people say, well, you know, you when I meet you in person, you seem so much warmer and friendlier than how you are on social media. Well, it's not because my disposition has changed. It's just because on social media, there are so many imbeciles and morons that even though I can be patient 99% of the time, that 1% where somebody gets under my skin, then you'll see me as being too spicy in my retort and so on. But the reality is, it's part of my personhood to fight back when I hear untruths.
Yeah, I actually get the same response. I'm very nice in person, but on social media, I'm also offended. I'm hurt, you know. I'm also offended when I see, there's this boy that's gone viral. Boy, I don't know, trans girl, called Dylan, who's basically it's not blackface, but it's like woman face. He's just trivializing everything it means to be a woman and right. laughing and all this stuff. And you know, it's really not that simple being a woman. So I'm like, sit down, you know. but it's crazy. And I do think that it is a replacement of religion, because I feel like, especially over the last 2 years with the masks, a lot of the time we live in such a pathetic society where everybody's getting participation trophies. And so they have nothing to feel proud of other than I'm going to wear my mask because I'm adding value to society. I'm contributing, because they've never contributed for once in their life to any decent cause.
100%. Instead of speaking about the mask and the COVID, a couple of weeks ago, I had, I don't know, are you familiar with the Great Barrington Declaration? Do you know what that is?
I'm not.
It was a open letter that was written by three professors questioning some of the draconian COVID policies that had been put in place, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so one of those co-authors came on my show. His name is Jay Bhattacharya. And it's astonishing that in the 21st century, he's a professor of medicine and professor of health economics at Stanford, right? So it's not as though he's lacking in credentials. But if you see how this gentleman and true scholar, very highly accomplished scholar, if you see how he was demonized by the mask religious people, it's just unbelievable to think that this is where our discourse is, which basically, in a sense, speaks to the continuity of how easy we are to be parasitized as a human species. It speaks to my earlier point, which is, yes, today we are succumbing to particular idea pathogens, but the fact that human beings can be parasitized has been with us since time immemorial. And so it's very disheartening, because my original training as a doctoral student was in psychology of decision-making, and I studied things like rational choice behavior. And so rationality has been at the root of my doctoral training. And to see us now completely depart from any semblance of rationality and people consider that laudable is very disheartening. And this is why I fight, Leah.
I can understand that. Can you explain to me how the cognitive dissonance works? Because over the last 2 years, the weirdest one for me was my body, my choice. You know, that's what we've been drilled into our heads. But then when it comes to taking the magic medicine, no, it's your body, my choice. So how does that cognitive dissonance work? Like, how do you get there?
Yeah, so prior to answering that specific example, cognitive dissonance, of course, is itself a very alluring trap across many domains. So as someone who studies consumer psychology, when we make a purchase, so I'm about to choose between Toyota or Mazda, and I decide to buy the Mazda, the mere fact that I've now signed the contract to buy the Mazda, cognitive dissonance sets in because, oh, I think I should have chosen Toyota, right? Now, what we then end up doing, in this case, as consumers, is we implement some cognitive strategies to assuage our cognitive dissonance. So for example, if I see any incoming information that supports the decision that I've made, I will amplify it in my head. If I see any information that is contrary to the final decision I make, then I will discount the veracity of that information. Oh, it's my uncle who said this, and he's a moron. Everybody knows that. He's a drunk. And so therefore, there are all sorts of cognitive strategies that I can use to assuage that internal inconsistency in my head. By the way, the pioneer of cognitive dissonance theory is a very well-known social psychologist named Leon Festinger. So for those of you who want to look up, so that's the original genesis of cognitive dissonance theory. So, but to your point, I think people are perfectly happy to be irrational and hold completely cognitively inconsistent beliefs in their head as long as it fits the political dogma that they are ascribing to. So to me, it doesn't surprise me in the least bit that they're doing exactly what you're saying. That's part and parcel of the human spirit, regrettably.
That's so fascinating, because if I see myself contradicting myself, I will then like check in with myself and think, oh, hang on, I need to reassess my views.
That means because you're intellectually honest, and I think most people are not. Let's take that honesty to an extreme form. So I'm mm-hmm. someone who is maladaptively perfectionist. Okay. So for example, when I receive the galley proofs of my latest books, the galley proofs is sort of the final version that you have one more chance to go over to make sure that there are no errors. Well, I go into a complete panic because I'm now worried, what if there is a comma that is misplaced somewhere that I missed? So I have a very purist bent, and that allows me to then exactly do what you did, which is I'm always very clean cognitively. If I see any inconsistencies, I'm going to do exactly what you said that you do, which is I'm going to work through them so that my edifice of justifications for my positions are very clean. Or going back earlier, my nomological network is very, very tight. It's unassailable. But again, that takes intellectual honesty, and it also takes intellectual humility, because if you identify a cognitive inconsistency in you, it means that somewhere you went wrong and that you're willing to admit that you went wrong. But of course, if you're dogmatic, especially when it comes to these hot button political issues, dogma overrules intellectual honesty, and therefore, la la la, I don't want to hear about my cognitive inconsistencies.
That's so fascinating. It is to do with being intellectually honest. I do it a lot. And I have an example, but it's a whole can of worms, which I won't get into, but I'll very, very briefly tell you a story very briefly. I tried to actually move to Israel when I was a couple years ago, in the heart of the pandemic. And long story short, I wasn't vaccinated. And I got treated very badly by a bunch of different locals. And what happened was I basically nearly ended up homeless one night because I wasn't vaccinated, so I couldn't get a hotel. So I then had an epiphany moment, which was like, I'm in a country that's happy to discriminate against me because I'm unvaccinated.
Wow.
I was like, shit, what does that mean about everything that I've heard in the news about this country, discriminating against certain people for the greater good of greater reasons, blah, 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 blah. But that moment for me, I was like, now I'm on the other side of the discrimination. And that was a hard moment for me. Like, that's when my reality shattered.
Well, first, thank you so much for sharing that personal story. But was it shortly thereafter that you decided Israel's not for me and I need to look for other pastures?
I gave it six more weeks.
Okay.
I found a place. I actually stayed at a random man's house. He let me in. He lived with his mom. He was like, I promise it's safe. I live with my mother. I was like, okay. So I stayed, and my dad spoke to him on the phone. My dad speaks Hebrew. It was fine. But it was that moment that I was like, yeah, that's when the intellectual honesty really set in. And I was like, I need to reevaluate the way I look at everything now.
Wow. And so all of the incredibly handsome military guys wearing their commando suits did not tilt you towards staying in Israel, apparently.
If I was 18 years old, yes, not in my 20s, not in my mid-20s when I'm a lot more intelligent.
It's interesting that you say this because it speaks, by the way, to an evolutionary fact, which is that there are certain mating attributes that we view as terribly important at one stage in our life that become less important or vice versa. And you're speaking exactly to that point. So that makes sense.
Yeah, like the evolutionary thing, which I think is like the most important, is a mutual agreed mentality that freedom above everything else.
For yes.
Me, like, that's key. Yeah. Like if you're happy to, like, you know, bend over daddy government and do what they say just so that you can, you know, live freely. I can't, that, to me, that's quite dangerous. And so that's what I saw a lot of over there. And I thought, yeah, wow, I'm a different person now to who I was like 5 years ago.
But, and by the way, I mean, your point about sort of assorting on those fundamental beliefs is supported by the scientific literature. Specifically, your viewers might be interested in knowing this, that so there are two competing ideas. One is birds of a feather flock together, or opposites attract. And it turns out that over the long term, if what you're looking for is the likelihood of your union being successful over the long term, say a marriage, then it's overwhelmingly birds of a feather flock together that predicts that reality. That's actually something that I discuss in my next book, because in the next book I talk about you know, how to live the good life, because people always say you always seem to be smiling, you're like the happy professor, what's the secret? And so I said, you know what, let me write my attempt of explaining what makes me happy and what is the route to happiness. And so one of the things I talk about is choosing the right spouse. And in there, I talk about the fact that it is fundamentally important to choose someone with whom the fundamental values that define your everyday life, you share them. If not, you're likely to fail.
That's so fascinating. So yeah, I want to hear this. So what are you working on now? And can we hear a little bit more about this book? Because yeah,
sure.
Everybody wants to know how to be with a smile 24/7. So what's the secret?
So the book is, I mean, I think it's going to end up being the final title. It's The Sad Truth About Happiness. Sad, of course, S-A-A-D. And I actually just earlier today, I was speaking to the publisher. We had different possibilities for the book cover, but I think they want to go with just an actual photo of me smiling, since many people see me as that. So what do I do in the book? I basically argue that there are certain decisions that we can take and certain mindsets that we can adopt that augment the likelihood of us living a happy life. Now, part of it, by the way, cannot be under your control, because part of it is just dispositional. You know, some people are happier than others. And now, I was fortunate enough to be born with a sunny disposition, but that only covers about 50% of, if you like, your happiness score. So the good news is that there's still a big, big chunk that is within your personal agency that you could change. So what are some of these? So in terms of decisions that you can take that either impart great misery or great happiness, one is certainly choosing the right spouse. And two is choosing a profession that grants you that purpose and meaning. And I argue in the book that a sure path to feeling fulfilled is to be in professions where your creative impulse can be instantiated. Because the creative impulse, whether it be I'm creating a dish as a chef, or I'm creating a bridge as an architect, or I'm creating content as you are as a podcast host, there is something quite exhilarating about something not having been there before you came along, and then through your creative impulse, this comes about. So I talk about that. But then I also discuss a whole bunch of mindsets that can either increase our happiness or not. And by the way, many people might say, well, there's probably no topic that's been written about more than how to be happy. What are you going to add? Well, what I'm going to add is my unique story, and then backed up with science as I see it. So trust me, there's all kinds of novel stuff in there. Let me mention a few. So I talk about at one point about life as a playground, as a mindset of how to live life. So people say, but you know, doesn't it demean you when you joke around as this fancy professor? No, it doesn't, right? Because I can both be the austere, serious professor who speaks at Stanford University, as I did two weeks ago, and I can also be the satirist who hides under my desk satirically, because I am very comfortable in my personhood that I don't have to put a false aura of profundity so that you could take me seriously as a professor. When I do my research, it's a form of play. The research is very serious, but what greater play is there than to uncover relationships between patterns in nature? That's science, right? So in the same way that a child solves a puzzle, well, science is just one big epistemological puzzle. So I could even tackle science with a playful twinkle in my eye. And so that would be an example. I'll give you maybe one or two others. You tell me when you want me to stop.
No, this is great. I think I'll just quickly say, when you're talking about, you know, balancing being serious versus being satirical, I think that balance is beautiful. I think it's very endearing, actually. A lot of people that are, you know, doctors, professors, and all these things, they often remain serious all the time, and it's unpleasant, actually. And I think you manage to spread your message in a much more effective way by being more relatable, because you're not serious all the time. So yeah, I think it's very endearing.
Oh, that's lovely for you to say. And you know, it's funny, because when I get approached often in the street, sometimes I'm taken aback by how friendly and familiar people are, but then I realize it's precisely because of that, because people feel like you're their friend. And I like that. I don't want to be the, you know, Dr. Saad, don't approach him. I mean, that means my message is resonating. I mean, you and I are in the business of hopefully creating stuff that makes people happy, that challenges them, that they say, my God, I benefited so much from listening to Leia this past hour. So I want you to come up to me and be nice and be sweet. I'm never blasé about people coming up to me. So I appreciate you saying that. Okay, a couple of more. One of the things I talk about is variety seeking, you know, as a mindset that can give you happiness. But of course, like all things in life, in some instances, variety seeking can be condemned. So I talk in the book about sexual variety seeking, food variety seeking, and intellectual variety seeking. Well, to the first one, sexual variety seeking, it might be a problem when you're in a monogamous union. And so how do you navigate the tension between our innate penchant to seek variety and certain moral contracts that we have signed on to that don't condone that? So I talk about that. I'll do one more if you'd like. I talk about, so the ancient Greeks talked about everything in moderation, right? The idea that too little of something is not good, too much of something is not good. Aristotle himself in his ethics book talked about the soldier. If the soldier is too reckless in his courage, then he's an idiot because he's going to die. And of course, if he's too cowardly, then he's not a good soldier. Somewhere in the middle lies the sweet spot. And so I have a chapter on explaining how everything in life is driven by that equation. So for example, the intensity with which I exercise turns out to be optimal at a moderate level. If I exercise at too low a level or too high a level, it's less good than if I exercise at a moderate level. How much consumption of different types of foods all follows the inverted U. Too little is not good, too much is not. And so I have many, many other such examples. So basically the book is a completely novel way of looking at how to climb, if you'd like, to mount happiness. Hopefully, if I've done a good job, it will get me to buy a house right next to yours in Miami.
Well, I can't wait to read it. That sounds amazing, especially the bit about picking a spouse and how you do that. God, that's a nightmare. So I can't wait to read it. How can people follow everything that you're doing, you know, check out other books that you have? How can people keep in touch with you?
Thanks for asking. So on Twitter, I'm at Gad, G-A-D-S-A-A-D. I have a public Facebook page. I don't remember the URL, but it's not difficult to get. I'm on Instagram. I also have my own personal website, gadsad.com. I've got the YouTube channel, which 2 years ago, I then also now made it into a podcast, because a lot of people kept complaining that they don't want to sit there in front of YouTube streaming. They want to be jogging and listening to my mellifluous deep voice while they're jogging. And so about 2 years ago, I started the podcast. So there's all sorts of places you can connect with me. Send me an email. I try to read all of them. Not sure if I could answer all of them, but I would love to hear from folks.
Amazing. Is there anything else you'd like to share that I haven't asked or that I haven't covered?
No. Simply, I'm envious of your radiant skin tone. I wish that I was there with you in beautiful Florida. I know that many of my friends who have moved to Florida, most notably Dave Rubin, he doesn't lose an opportunity to remind me that I need to be moving to Florida ASAP. So hopefully one day from my lips to God's ear, I will be joining you at some beach in Florida.
Yeah, you have to. This is truly one of the best places in the world, minus having to pay taxes, but better taxes than in Canada. But no, it's the best place. Everybody's very like-minded. It's such a pleasure to be able to speak so freely and not be around crazy woke people. That's why I like Florida. But Gad, I want to thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. I've learned so much from you, and I'm really, really looking forward to your next book. I cannot wait to give it a read.
Thank you. You're a delight. Thank you so much for having me. Cheers.
Thank you. And everyone, please make sure to hit the like button and subscribe, and we'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
The Leah Heilpan Show.